Well, good evening, everyone. Good evening and welcome. It's great to see you. My name is Moss Bresnahan, and I'm the CEO of Illinois Public Media, your public TV and radio stations. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to this very special evening tonight, because you are the public and public television and public radio. We couldn't do any of what we do without your support. So I thank you so much. Our mission is really to use the power of public broadcasting to advance education and culture and good citizenship, in-depth reporting, great storytelling, all to just improve our community and a healthy democracy. And that's all a reflection of the good work that the good support that you provide us. And of course, we do that through NPR, one of the premier news organizations in our country. I don't know what I'd do without NPR. It's through PBS, the best television on television, still 50 years later. Yeah, let's give NPR and PBS a big round of applause. And it's also through our own local programming, which I'm very, very proud of. Our own award-winning WILL Newsroom, our talk show, The 21st, which just completed its first year, and is now heard on 5 NPR stations around the state, and has won a number of awards already. And we're launching our new statewide news service called the Illinois Newsroom later this month, and that's going to bring more reporters to cover the really critical beats that are so important to our state and our region. Beats like public policy, education, the environment and sustainability. We're going to be working on more investigative and data-driven journalism. So that's all very, very exciting for us as we move on. I mean, it's a very challenging time for everybody in journalism. As many of you have probably noticed, local newspapers have had to scale way back on their coverage. Local TV newsrooms have scaled way back. Science and environmental reporting has been hit particularly hard, where newspapers and even cable networks have eliminated entire science bureaus. And one of the things that public broadcasting is so good at, and what's so important about what we do, is we respond to those failures in the marketplace, those things that are so important to our society that the commercial guys just can't or won't do. And so public radio does more and more of that. So thank goodness for NPR and PBS and local stations like WILL. And again, we're able to do that because it all comes back to you. We're able to do that because we're not beholden to commercial interests. We're able to do that because we have so many great listeners, but also great supporters who not only listen, but make it all happen. So thanks to each and every one of you for all that you do for Illinois Public Media. Well, tonight it's my pleasure to welcome one of the nation's most celebrated science journalists to Illinois Public Media, Richard Harris. Richard has reported on a wide range of topics in science and medicine and the environment since he joined NPR in 1986. In early 2014, his focus shifted from an emphasis on climate change and the environment to biomedical research. He took a year-long sabbatical to explore the issues facing biomedical research, which led to his first book, Rigor Mortis, which we'll hear more about. And from the rave reviews already, it's obviously a very important and at times unsettling book based on his careful investigation of the biomedical research enterprise. And I look forward to hearing more about all that very shortly. Now, Richard has traveled to all 7 continents for NPR. His reports have originated from Timbuktu, the South Pole, the Galapagos Islands, Beijing during the SARS epidemic, the center of Greenland, the Amazon rainforest, the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro, Japan after the aftermath of the 2011 tsunami, and now Champaign-Urbana. So, in 2010, his reporting revealed that the blown-out BP oil well in the Gulf of Mexico was spewing out far more oil than asserted in the official estimates. And that revelation led to the federal government to make a more realistic assessment of the extent of the spill. He covered climate change for decades and was a major contributor to NPR's award-winning Climate Connection series. And over the course of his career, Richard has been the recipient of many prestigious awards. He shared the 2009 National Academy of Sciences Communication Award and a 1995 Peabody Award for his investigative reporting about the tobacco industry. And the American Association for the Advancement of Science has honored Richard 3 times with its Top Science Journalism Award. It's also my pleasure to welcome Brian Moline, who will be moderating tonight's discussion. He is, as you all know, the voice of Morning Edition. He's the managing editor of news at Illinois Public Media. He's a board member at the Illinois News Broadcasters Association, a past Silver Dome Award winner, and co-host of the Bandwagon podcast, among many other things. So would you all please join with me in welcoming Richard Harris and Brian Moline up onto the stage.
Good evening. This is going to be a fairly relaxed, just a little question and answer here with Richard and myself, and then we'll open it up for you to ask questions in a little while as well. Richard, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here, absolutely, yeah.
I thought it would be nice to let the audience get to know you just a little bit, you know, before we delve into rigor mortis and some other more serious topics here. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you became so interested in science.
I grew up in California, actually. I have a degree in biology, and when I spent some time in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. My journalism career started there, and actually one of my roommates grew up in this area and went to school in Illinois, and I've heard about, I think he called it shampoo banana or something, but I've always had this sort of mythical sense of that this place existed. But he was, by the way, the oldest of 12 children, all boys.
Wow.
No, should not come as a surprise that his career ended up being in pediatrics. So he's a very successful pediatrician. But when I was living in San Francisco briefly, he was in medical school and we were, you know, just getting going. So at any rate, but I loved thinking about science and when I was an undergraduate, and as I say, I got a bachelor's degree in biology. But I thought, you know, a career in science didn't quite appeal to me, and I thought, what else could I do? And in journalism, science writing, science journalism came to mind. A nice way to keep my finger in it and being able to look across all of the sciences and think about all the cool things that are happening, but not actually have to have successful experiments. So, and worry about getting grants and all those other things that scientists do. So, but I did come to NPR. So I started out in San Francisco Bay Area, but I came to NPR a long time ago, 1986. So I've been there more than 30 years. And obviously, I'm still deciding whether I like it, but I think I do pretty well, actually.
Just knowing that, you know, how long you have been with NPR, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen, not only with NPR, but with science reporting over the last 30 years?
Yeah, well, it's hard to maintain that perspective, right? But I mean, the most obvious thing is the technology. When I came to NPR, we were recording on reel-to-reel tapes, 10-inch reels of quarter-inch tape, and if you wanted to make an edit, you pulled out a razor blade and you literally cut the tape with a razor blade and just splice it together with splicing tape and so on. So just the technology has made a huge difference. But the technology has actually changed the way we tell stories too, though, a little bit, because it used to be so hard to cut tape. It's like if you go back and listen to an old story on NPR, you realize you hear people talking for 30 seconds before the reporter goes back, because it was such a nuisance and it's such a challenge to cut the tape. It's like, well, we, you know, it's like, okay, let it roll a little bit. And with digital editing, we were able to be much snappier. And I think it actually, it picks up the pace of journalism, of what we report and how we write. And I think it's actually good, because I think reports are snappier and more engaging. But that's the more obvious stuff. But clearly there's been so many changes in the media over the last 30 years with watching the newspaper struggle. I'm really grateful that NPR was set up, thanks to people like you, with a funding structure that really allowed us to weather a lot of that storm and be able to say, we're still going, we're still going strong, we have a really good business model. People love us enough to give us money and keep us going, and so we're not dependent upon the classified ads that really killed the newspaper business and all this other stuff. And we can keep, so interestingly for me, I can just keep doing what I've been doing for all these years with more depth and a lot of patience, but still it's like fundamentally I can just say, what's the most important story? And my editor will say, I agree, even if it's gonna take you a month or 2 months to do it, go do it. And that's a luxury that so few journalists have in the United States these days. And I think it's part of really what makes NPR so strong.
Yeah. And just thinking about your journey from environment and climate science to biomedical science reporting, what prompted that change for you?
Yeah, well, over the years, 30 years at NPR, I've covered practically everything. When I first got there, I actually replaced, remember this guy named Ira Flatto? He was actually a science reporter at NPR before he went off and did all these other things, including this wonderful Science Friday show that he does now, but I was hired to replace him, so that's how long ago I got to NPR. But in those early days, it was me and, anyone remember the name Lori Garrett? She and I were sort of responsible for the entire waterfront of science and medicine and everything else. And over the years, as the science desk has grown, as people have recognized the value of what we do, more and more people have joined on. And so now I have all these wonderful colleagues, from Dan Charles, who covers agricultural stuff, to Allison Aubrey, who's doing nutrition and related stories, and Joe Palka, and on. You know all the names, of course. It's been a wonderful place to be, but to see a bit of everything. But of course, every time they add somebody who has a great specialty, it's like, okay, you don't have to cover that anymore. So my beat has changed gradually over the years as the science desk has grown. And what happened really in 2014 was there was a reshuffling at NPR. There was a number of people left, and NPR sort of rethought the best way to structure the news desk, and one of the prominent people who left, or one of the sort of key players who'd been covering medicine for many years, was Richard Knox. And they said, and when he left, they said, well, you know, that's a hole we don't want to leave unfilled. So they said, would you move from covering climate? We'll have other people do climate and other environmental stuff. Would you move back to your old beat you covered years ago in biomedicine? And I said, sure. So I was obviously a little rusty, and I spent some time trying to figure out, you know, what is this world like these days? But that's how I ended up back in the world of biomedicine.
Yeah, Moss touched on maybe your best known story for NPR about the BP oil spill and the flow rates of the oil that was coming out of the Gulf. How did you go about, I guess, breaking that story, figuring out what exactly was happening there?
Yeah, well, of course, that was the big story of 2010, I think it was the year, mm-hmm. right? And this is an amazing environmental catastrophe. And NPR was thinking, how are we going to deal with this? And one of the editors said to me, just follow your nose. You know, we're not putting you on the daily story right now. Just do what, you know, just figure it out. He actually said, we're going to send you down to the Gulf and you find your own stories. And I had my bag packed. I even had a boarding pass. But sort of in the process of doing all of that, I had talked, I know a lot of scientists from over the years, and one of the scientists I knew was a guy named Ian McDonald, who had studied for many years the natural oil seeps in the Gulf of Mexico, because of course oil ultimately is a natural product, right? And some of it just seeps up from under the Gulf. And so he had been studying this totally natural phenomenon, and when the spill came, he was really interested and knowledgeable about the geology and the biology and everything else. And so I talked to him practically every day about what was going on and what his perceptions were. And he kept saying, you know, they've got the spill rate wrong. They can't be right. It can't be right. I said, why do you say that? And he said, well, the Coast Guard and NOAA and so on, when they measure the oil spills, the way they do it makes sense for a lot of oil spills, which is that they look how much oil is on the surface of the water. If a tanker is cracked or whatever, it spills out. That's a totally natural thing to do. And then they say, they look at the extent of it, they fly over it, they map how big it is, and then you can tell by the sheen, sort of the color of the oil, how thick it is. And so you can, with fairly simple mathematics, you can determine the area, the sheen tells you what the thickness is, and that tells you how much oil is spilled. He said, that's what they're doing for this spill, but that's wrong. It can't be right, because this oil is coming up from 5,000 feet under the Gulf. The spill is almost a mile beneath the surface, and the oil is percolating up through the water. It's going hither and yon. It's being caught by currents and so on. That can't be the right way to think of the oil spill. And I said, okay, you know, I agree with you. How do I do it? He said, I don't know, but I know what they're doing is wrong. And so we talked every day or every other day about this. One of the many people I talked to, the scientists in this field, and one day he said, did you see CNN? I said, no, I didn't see CNN. What was on CNN? He said, got to go check CNN, because the BP had put down some submersibles, these robotic submarines, and they were taking pictures of what was going on down there. And CNN, as a It turns out that the Coast Guard was using this as a visual background. One day they decided, we'll just show in the background of this press conference what's going on with this. You can sort of see the oil pouring out of this pipe on the seafloor. And I said to Ian, yeah, and? He said, I have no idea how to do that, but there are people out there who know how to look at the amount of, visually look at oil flow like that and tell you how much, what the volume is. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, so I called around, it took a day or two, actually this happened rather rapidly, but I called around and found scientists who knew how to do this. The first guy I called was actually at Brown University. He said, oh yeah, I can do that. He said, but it's finals week, I can't do it right now. Can you call me back in a week or two? And I said, no, I don't think so. He said, well, if you can't do that, what you really want to do is find somebody who's an expert in PIV. I said, PIV? He said, yeah, particle image velocimetry. I said, right, in particle image velocimetry. And so then I started noodling around until I found people who really knew that technique. And that turns out to be the technique that allows you to look visually at an image and determine the velocity of the particles and therefore the flow rate from that. And so I found one guy who's an expert in this PIV technology. I thought, who else? I don't want just a one-source story, of course. So who else can I talk to? And I thought, well, I know there are people who study these natural volcanoes that are belching out. They're called black smokers, and they're on the bottom of the seafloor, and they're belching out material. And I bet they have made some efforts to figure out what the flow rate is from them. So I called somebody there who was at Woods Hole Oceanographic, Mont Doherty, whatever, and I said, yeah. I had a copy of the video by then that CNN had been running in the background. Sent one to him. I sent one to the guy who knew all about PIV, and I sent one to it turns out that there was a physicist at Berkeley who's an astrophysicist. It's like not necessarily your first choice for someone to talk about the oil spill, but it turns out that just sort of for fun, because astrophysicists like to say, I can calculate anything just giving, you know, first principles. I'm not gonna give you a really precise answer, but I'll give you a broad answer. And the astrophysicist had also been intrigued by this idea, and so he went off and he looked at the video, and he was detecting a flow rate. And I talked to all three of them, and they all came back with an answer that was, not exactly the same, but they were all within the same definite ballpark, and they were all about 10 times bigger than what the government was saying that at that point, how much the oil spill was spewing out. So I put that on the air. I went to the editorial meeting in the evening, and I said, oh, I've got a good story for Morning Edition tomorrow, and the managing editor said, yeah, and so I described it, and he said, I don't want you to wait till Morning Edition. Put it on All Things Considered tonight. That we were already in the second feed, so we'd already had one cycle of the show. So I went in and I said, okay. So we put it in the later feed of All Things Considered. The White House called and said, oh, we don't believe that. It's like, oh, you don't? I said, well, would you like to, I'd be happy to interview somebody at the White House who says it's wrong, and they say, well, we'll get back to you. and of course, they did not get back to me, but then the full story was on Morning Edition the next day, and the White House was sort of in conniptions for a little while because, you know, the context of this was the BP oil spill happened when they were trying to cut a big energy deal. They had, the Obama administration had a big idea about how to increase renewables and do all of these other things, but part of it was, as part of this political package, they really wanted to open some areas of offshore oil to further exploration. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't want the message out there that offshore oil exploration was a big deal. And so they were trying to say, such a shame about the BP oil spill, but it's not really that big a deal, and so on. And this obviously didn't fit into that narrative. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, so I put my story on the air. The White House actually never did call back, although the next morning they were on the morning talk show saying, I'm not sure I believe that, blah, blah, blah. But then within a week or two, they almost immediately put together a panel of scientists to do what I had done and try to analyze all of the sources of information. In a week or two, they realized, yeah, that's right, you know. We kind of missed that one. And so it's sort of an example for me of, you know, I'm a science reporter, right? And this was both a scientific story, but also a political story. But it was sort of an opportunity for me just to use my basic skills to sort of probe deeper and deeper into a story and say, this is what's really going on, folks, and ultimately, thankfully, the people I interviewed and who did all of the who did the legwork that I pulled together into a single story or a couple of stories turned out to be right. So, really reset the whole trajectory of how the administration responded to the BP oil spill.
You know, talking about the importance of science, and of course that's, you know, that's the subject of your new book, Rigor Mortis, and part of the subtitle of that is Sloppy Science. How did you begin seeing that this was really a big issue, particularly in biomedical science, that a lot of the research that was being published just wasn't quite up to snuff?
Yeah, actually, an asterisk about the title of the book. I went back and forth a lot with my publisher about what to call this book, and my working title was Science Friction. The idea that this was slowing down the progress of science. Science is still moving forward, for sure, but some of these mistakes were slowing it down. And if you could reduce science friction, you could move science ahead faster. But the publisher said, "No, we like rigor mortis better, and let's throw sloppy into the title too." So that happened. But yeah, it came out of my reporting initially from NPR when I started getting oriented to the biomedical beat that I hadn't been paying that much attention to. I noticed the funding had doubled in a very short period of time, and then it started declining, and actually for a decade in spending power, the amount of money available through the NIH had decreased by 20%. And I thought, that can't be good. You double the budget, all these people rush into biomedicine. Universities around the country actually increased laboratory space by 50% as a result of this huge surge of federal money. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, and by the way, we're not paying you anymore to keep those laboratories up and humming. And it's like, that can't be good. The other thing that I noticed was a number of studies by people in the pharmaceutical industry who said, we're trying really hard to reproduce the studies that are coming out of academia, and we're not having a very high success rate. In fact, it's 15%, 25%. And I thought, this is probably related. So I did some stories in 2014 for NPR about this, and then I realized there's more here, and if I can spend some time really investigating this, I think I've got a bigger story. And so I said, hey, can I have a book leave? And I got a book contract, and Rigor Mortis was born.
Very good. So in your research for the book, how did we get to where we are? You mentioned the funding, the federal funding was certainly a part of that. How did that influence what was going on in the laboratories and what was coming out in those studies that could not be reproduced?
Yeah, there are many factors at play, but one of them is the incentives are wrong. If you're a scientist, all of a sudden it's all about getting funding for your next grant. Your laboratory lives or dies on whether or not you can get your grant. And to get your grant, you need to have a publication, preferably in Science or Nature or Cell or one of these big, big journals. In order to get a publication in one of those journals, you have to have amazing results. And so all of a sudden the incentives are to say, oh, well, that experiment didn't work, but it won't count because it's not going to help me with my tell my story. And it's not, I don't think it's not cheating, it's not deliberate, but what happens, however an incentive system is set up, people will respond to it. And the incentives in academic journalism or academic science right now are basically to be able to publish. That's the coin of the realm, is getting those publications. And it doesn't particularly matter if 2 years down the line, it turns out your publication didn't pan out. You still have your citation from Nature 2017 or whatever like that, and so the incentives got really messed up as a result of the way the funding is flowing. And I don't believe there is a little bit of deliberate cheating, but I think that's a very, very small portion of what's going on. I think largely what's going on is people are responding to the reality of how academic medicine and biomedical research is structured, and I think that's the problem, and that's not an easy problem to solve. But that's what my book looked at: people who are recognizing that, addressing that, and saying, what can we do, both individually as scientists, as institutions like universities, and as the broader federal organization, to try to make this happen. Nobody wants to spend their time doing studies that don't turn out to be true. I mean, it's not rewarding if you're a scientist to do that. It doesn't help the taxpayer. You don't get new drugs out of it, so the drug companies don't benefit. It doesn't help human health. And so nobody wants to be trapped in this situation, but that, unfortunately, is the reality right now.
As you talked to scientists, those in academia, about, you know, what you were finding, what did they have to tell you?
when I went into reporting this book, I thought no one's going to want to talk to me. It's like, oh, I want to call you up and talk to you about your dirty laundry, okay? What, Tuesday, okay? But much to my surprise, almost everybody said, of course I'll talk to you. People have become growingly aware of this, or increasingly aware of this, and they don't like this state of affairs, and they are concerned about it. It's usually, oh yeah, this is a big problem. It's, you know, the guys down the hall, you won't believe how bad their science is, but you know, I talked to numerous Nobel laureates. I talked to the head of the NIH, who acknowledges that this is a really significant problem, the top drug approver at the FDA. I mean, all sorts of people across the spectrum of science. And I'm not making this stuff up. This is on their minds, and they are concerned about this. And people really opened up. People spent a lot of time saying, I'm worried about this. We got to figure out what to do. Here's the problems I see. And some people said, here are the solutions that I'm toying with, and were happy to have me come and talk to them and listen to them as they talked about, well, maybe we could try this. Maybe we could improve in education of scientists, or maybe we could, if we increase transparency in data, that when scientists do an experiment, if you make their data more available, maybe that would help deal with some of these issues. So people had ideas they were happy to share. And it turned out to be surprisingly easy to find people to talk to, and you know, people opened up their offices, their time, they cleared their calendars, and it was really very gratifying to be able to talk to people and say, okay, I'm gonna tell the story the best I can.
What were some common threads in what those scientists had to tell you in some solutions, some possible solutions for this problem?
Yeah, well, I mentioned transparency, which is a very powerful idea, because if you, scientists are gonna make mistakes. I mean, we all make mistakes, right? And science is hard. They're working at the frontiers, the edges of knowledge, and you cannot and you shouldn't expect that everything they do is correct. One of the questions is, science is a self-correcting process. The question is, how long does it take for that self-correction to happen? And so some scientists say, if you make the data more readily available, that self-correction can happen that much faster. And so people don't spend so much time running down a blind alley that turns out to be wrong, that they spend more time saying, that turned out to be wrong. Okay, that's fine. We'll go. Let's find out what the right path is. And so there's a big push for transparency, for one thing. Another idea that I heard voiced a lot was, let's improve the way that we teach science to young scientists. Scientists generally in academia learn from their mentors, and some of their mentors are terrific, but many of their mentors don't have a good grasp of statistics, for example, and there are lots of statistical errors that crop up in the biomedical literature. So let's rethink how we teach young scientists to do science, and if we're lucky, maybe once they know the right way to do it, they can talk to their bosses and say, you know, a better way to do this might be this. And so some of these ideas actually could percolate upward into the scientists who are running the labs and so on. And so I think that's another powerful idea. I think just rethinking the incentives, how do you, if you tell a scientist that your tenure evaluation is going to be judged on how many papers you've published, of course you're going to publish as many papers as you can. But if you say, we're only going to look at your 3 or 4 best publications, then that all of a sudden changes the incentives to say, I'm going to spend my time pursuing a few really interesting ideas and pursue them carefully. And the volume of what I publish doesn't matter so much, but getting it right and having some really good ideas makes a difference. And if you could, to the extent that you can convince tenure committees and hiring committees to think more broadly about those issues, I mean, for my money, I would rather have scientists publish a lot less, but everything they publish would be closer to correct. And if you can make that happen, I think that solves this problem a lot. But the incentives aren't set up to do that right now. You're rewarded for having a lot of papers, particularly having a lot of papers in big name journals. So it takes action on the level of the scientists, on the chairman of departments, the deans throughout the university, which unfortunately also relies on these scientists to bring in funding. So then that also means you have to have buy-in from the funding agencies who say, okay, we're not, you have to deal with every element of the system. And it's really hard to get all of those elements to cooperate with one another. But ultimately, I think my hope is if people recognize this is the problem, this is the direction we have to go, that you'll be able to, you know, everyone can do what they can do in their position, and collectively we'll move in the right direction.
You've had a very full day here in your first visit to Champaign-Urbana. You were on the 21st show earlier today with Nyla Boodoo, and if anyone missed that interview, you can find it at our website. But you also had a meet and greet at the Beckman Institutes there on campus, and gave a talk this afternoon at the Spurlock Museum.
And I talked to journalism students too, and wow. I had lunch with the journalism faculty. So other than that, it's been a kind of quiet day.
Yeah, very quiet. So, I mean, what kind of questions were you getting, you know, today from, I guess I'll focus on the scientific community from your stop at maybe at the Beckman Institute and your talk this afternoon at Spurlock. What kind of questions were you getting today?
Well, of course, people were interested in my book, and it stirs a lot of conversation. One question that people have is like, is this really a conversation we'd be having right now? Because people are concerned about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and threats to cut the NIH budget and so on. It's like, why are you writing this book now? And I said, well, I wrote the book, you know, last year before the election. I had no idea what the outcome of the election would be. But my answer also is that if the instinct is, well, there's so much waste at the NIH, let's just cut the budget, all that does is make the problem worse. Because remember, the fundamental problem is that there's not enough funding for the number of people who are competing for it. So that has not become a real conversation in Washington, D.C., fortunately. But I have a good answer if it does become one. But I think that is something that people rightfully raise. And the other point is that once you realize something is a problem, let's not wait till there's a politically convenient time to address it. It's like, let's get on with it. Because the sooner that you get on with it, you know, the sooner we'll have the rewards from this research, which has, you know, provided us a tremendous amount of benefits over the years. And let's not forget that biomedical research is by no means perfect, but, you know, our lives are better. People live longer. There are drugs to treat diseases that didn't exist 10 or 20 years ago. And these are all good things. And let's not forget that as we're moving forward.
What's a story or two you're working on right now that we might hear on NPR in the next few weeks?
I'm working on a number of stories related to precision medicine, which is this idea that if you understand everyone's genome perfectly and their medical records and everything else, all of a sudden you'll have a complete understanding of what's wrong with somebody, and you'll have a complete prescription for treating them, and so on. I think that's an overpromise. I think there are valuable parts of precision medicine that we should pay attention to. But I've been talking to people who've been looking more deeply and thinking more deeply about what is precision medicine really? What can we really expect from it? Let's be realistic. I mean, it's an area certainly worth exploring. But if we are expecting it to be, you know, all of a sudden all questions are going to be answered. Once we really get down to every person's individual DNA scan, and then we'll, case closed, we'll be able to deal with everything. I think it's important to tamp down that expectation, because we are very, very far from that. But I've been talking to people and exploring those issues, because there clearly are good things that are happening in that world. But we just have to remain realistic about how far that will really take us.
Well, I think that's about all the questions I have for you, Richard. How about a nice round of applause for Richard Harris here? And now we'll open things up for some questions here from the audience. Raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll bring a microphone to you so that you can ask Richard. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Lydia Kisley. I'm a postdoc at the Beckman Institute, actually. So you mentioned the pressure of, I guess I feel this pressure, I'm going on the job market now, and God willing, I'll have my own lab in a couple of years, the publish or perish, and the focus on publishing in Science, Nature, Cell, these high impact journals. Since you're a journalist, do you go to those journals to find the stories you want to talk about? That's part of why there's this pressure to publish in those high impact journals.
That's true. It's a vicious cycle, and I am part of that cycle, because the funders, one of the reasons that scientists like you are more likely to get funding from publishing in that is that there you are rewarded if your findings get wide public acceptance, and we do go to those publications to do that. I've tried to cast a much wider net than that, so I'm not just looking at those journals and so on, that I'm finding interesting things that are happening outside of that world. But it is a vicious cycle, because the scientists say, if I have a really hot paper, I want to take it to those journals. And so I know that if, you know, some of those hottest of hot papers do end up in those journals. But I agree that the journalists are part of that problem. And I'm thinking about how to back away from that and not perpetuate a situation that really is very unfortunate. There are other journals like the PLOS journals and eLife, which is another journal that's published by the Wellcome Trust and by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, that are trying to break through this pattern of this vicious cycle. It's hard to do because, you know, I actually talked to a Nobel laureate when I was reporting the book, named Randy Scheckman, who's the editor of eLife, and the day before he got his Nobel Prize, he published a commentary in The Guardian, the British newspaper, saying, you know, talking about the tyranny of these terrible journals and how he intends to take them on, and partly by using eLife. And I was in his office at University of California at Berkeley, and at the end of the conversation, I got up and I was walking toward the door, and I looked down and I saw, oh, you have a framed cover of an issue of Cell right there. He said, yeah, that was one of my really good papers I got published. I was like, maybe I should take it down. It's like, but you know, it is hard. That's a wonderful example of how hard it is to break these kinds of cycles. But it's important to do.
I'd also like to add with that, you mentioned PLOS. There's also journals where the number of papers they're publishing has increased pretty much exponentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that also comes from this reproducibility in science where you have to publish. And there's these journals where it's like, okay, they used to publish 1,000, 2,000 papers a year. Now they're publishing 15,000 papers a year just so people can get things out. So I'd also like to comment on that. Mm-hmm. And
that's why I think it would be so much better if scientists published fewer papers but publish more meaningful results. But that, again, you have to change the incentive structure, because the incentive now is not to work that way.
Right? And I also, sorry to take more time, just one more quick comment with also the universities. Whenever I hear stories on NPR where they talk about some science from like a smaller school as opposed to Berkeley or Illinois, I'm always like, yay for the little guys. So also expanding the search from not just big name journals, but also smaller schools as well, is something I would like to comment on.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you very much for your question.
I'm Bob Switzer. I'm a veteran of 40 years of research in biochemistry and microbiology here at the University of Illinois. And I haven't read your book. But as a science reporter, as someone who wants to take a scientific approach to things, I think it's very important to be as precise as we can be about the magnitude of this problem. I mean, I think we need to have some clear idea of how big it is. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we have to have very objective measures of what is sloppy science and what isn't. Mm-hmm. We can't get good science from sloppy analysis. And that means we need more than anecdotes. We really need a very careful way of evaluating the quality of science. In my experience, the amount of irreproducible science that I saw in 40 years was not high. And that you mentioned the self-correcting nature of science. I saw that at work. I was on study sections. I was on the editorial boards of journals. So it's important. Many of the pressures you talk about, I agree with. I saw them. I experienced them. But it's possible to have a career of great integrity in science. I think it's very important that we be very careful what we tell the public about science. When we use phrases like sloppy science, we have the unintended consequence of encouraging. We have an administration that says fake news whenever it hears something it doesn't want to believe. And if we encourage an unhealthy attitude toward science, if we exaggerate its flaws, we unintentionally give support to things like the climate change doubters, for example, who insist that that's all fake science or sloppy science. Yeah. And I know you don't agree with that. So I'm asking simply that and I haven't read your book, so I don't know whether you've done this, but it's very important to have an objective, careful, quantitative measure of the nature of poor science or sloppy science or irreproducible science that exists out there.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment, and I agree. And unfortunately, the data are not that strong, but such as there are, I mean, I did my best to encapsulate what the best analysis is on that. I will say on your point about the administration, I think people who say, oh, climate change isn't real or so on, those are not scientific conversations, and we should not think that if we have a really strong scientific argument to rebut that, that that's going to make any difference at all. Those are totally ideological, non-scientific conversations, and I think that it's a different kind of argument that is at play there. So I agree with your fundamental point, but I also am less optimistic, perhaps, than you are, that you can actually have a rational argument about these issues with people who choose to ignore them. It's not a scientific argument. It's not a rational argument. People come to it with a different set of values, and you're never going to argue them out of their values. So I do appreciate your comment.
Okay, a couple questions up here toward the front, Aaron, if you can get the microphone up here.
I know there are some arguments that it's
right.
Not doing a job it should do, but I don't know. Certainly many of us have reviewed articles and done the best we could to make sure that they were sound.
Yeah. Questions about the peer review system, which the scientists, before something's published, it should go to peer review, and other scientists are supposed to read these articles and say, yeah, this makes sense to me, or it doesn't. And unfortunately, this does not tell a very complimentary story about peer review, because there are multiple reasons for that. But one is that many of the errors that crop up are, for example, bad statistical analyses and so on. And many in biomedical research, many scientists aren't really very well equipped to analyze those kinds of questions. So they're looking. Peer reviewer is going to look at, it's going to ask a certain number of questions about the study, but they may not ask the question about, was this the right statistical test? Was it done the right way? And those kinds of questions that can have a very big influence on these studies. I think the peer review system is not working very well, and I think that's another thing the scientific community needs to look at. How can we improve the peer review system? Some scientists are saying, let's just forget peer review. In the formal sense, some people have given up on it, and what we're seeing, at least on an experimental basis in biomedical research, is some scientists are publishing directly into what's called pre-publications. BioArchive is an online place where you have a manuscript, an interesting idea. Before you publish it, you post your article on BioArchive, and you ask your peers, did I do it right? What do you think about this? And people solicit comments before it has gone through formal peer review, and then those. Actually, publishers are watching those sites and saying, "Oh, that's a really interesting idea. I'm going to pick it up." And so there's different ways that scientists are now experimenting with peer review. There are blogs that are critiquing studies. I think probably the most destructive on the destructive end of this, there are people on Twitter who will say, "Oh, that's garbage. That's nonsense." And so peer review is happening. A sort of a knee-jerk kind of peer review is also cropping up here. So it's kind of social media is creeping into science in a peculiar way right now, and I'm watching that with interest to see how that's going to play out. I'm not sure that's salutary, honestly, but I think that they are pointing out that peer review should be catching more of these problems and is not, and how do you improve that system? So.
Okay, I have a question for you, Richard.
Yeah.
We have a great concern about the problems in our environment today, and I gather that you've been involved in reporting at some of these events around the world. So from your observations, what can you tell us about what you've seen in regard to global warming and the future of our water supply on the Earth?
Yeah. Well, the good news the good news about water is there's a set amount of water on Earth, so it's always going to be here. It may not be clean, unfortunately, but I've spent a lot of time reporting about and thinking about climate change, and that is, I think, when I look at my kids and imagine what my grandkids are going to be facing, I do worry a lot about what the planet is going to look like for future generations. And I think that's a problem that still, if we take it seriously and really engage, we still have time to do something about at least preventing the worst effects of it. But if we let it just go for another decade or two, there will be some changes that I think are likely to be irreversible. For example, melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is could add 20 feet of sea level. May not affect Champaign-Urbana that much, but it will affect a lot of other parts of this country if sea levels rise by 20 feet. And so those are. It's the problem of human nature is like, if that's a problem that's not going to be, you know, a really huge impact for 20 or 30 years, people say, well, I'm going to worry about something that's going to affect me tomorrow. But I think some of the water resource issues are also of concern. I think they're also maybe more manageable than climate change, but people, again, have to focus on them and say, you know, the glaciers that are melting in the Andes aren't going to keep melting forever, and when those are gone, what are the people in the Andes going to use for water for their agriculture? And that's a really important question to think about, even though it's not going to not probably going to be a problem the next 10 or 20 years or whatever. But yeah, I think it's incumbent upon us as citizens and as journalists and so on to sort of think about those bigger, longer term questions that are not necessarily at the top of mind. And when there's so many other distractions out there, so many other things competing for our attention, we should not lose sight of those longer term issues that will have a profound influence on our planet, for generations to come. Yeah, thank you for your question.
Okay, there's a couple questions down front here, Aaron. I'll get the mic to you.
Thanks. What are your thoughts about the journalistic practice of always trying to have both sides of an argument presented so that in some cases it presents a consensus opinion against a minority opinion, which will lead the public to think both are equal?
Yeah.
Climate change is a clear example of that.
Yeah, it is often cited as that, but I actually disagree with the analysis. I've actually looked very closely at some of those false equivalency reports, and I think they're actually, I actually think they miss the mark, honestly. I think where you do see that is in political debates, when climate change is argued on Capitol Hill. I understand why it's incumbent on a political reporter to say, here's what the Republicans say, here's what the Democrats say, and a political reporter may not have the wherewithal to say, here's what the scientists say, and that is a deficiency sometimes in political reporting when those things come up. But when you look at how science reporters cover climate change, you do not find that false equivalency. And I mean, I've been very clear, it's like, on the occasions where when I cover climate change, I mean, I don't want to exclude anyone's point of view, but when it's important to bring in a minority point of view, I say, for the purposes of a story or whatever, I say, here's this point of view, but it is not, it's not broadly accepted in the scientific community. And so you can talk about both sides of a story as long as you take care to say, here's where the consensus lies here, and if you're sophisticated enough to say, this is a strong argument, this is a weak argument, or at least make that plausibility, that make that as a plausible argument. You need to have a certain stature in order to be able to take that point of view. But actually, there was an early study that got quoted enormously by Al Gore and other peoples about this balance as bias, it was called, in climate change. And it was a deeply, deeply flawed study. And when it was interesting, it was done by a couple of young graduate students. And when they went off to get jobs at one of these guys, Max Boykoff, went off to get a job at University of Colorado working with a much more sophisticated lab. He redid the study a few years later and found it wasn't there at all. And his conclusion was, it was a real problem a few years ago and it's not a problem now. It's like, well, guess what, Max? I'm sorry to say, you blew it then, now you've got it straight. But that got embedded in Al Gore's shtick, unfortunately, and that whole idea took hold, and unfortunately, it's an example of bad science, and even the guy who did it, didn't admit it was a mistake, but he's now moved on and said, okay, that's not happening anymore. So,
I'd like to take you back to the medical field a little bit. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but my general thinking is that capitalism is getting in the way of medical research because We're doing things to make sure the drug companies have all the money that they can possibly get, and potentially even the doctors. I had the misfortune of, while traveling in Europe this summer, got sick. And I ended up in the lowest level of their system, which was the pharmacy, and honestly received a pretty thorough interrogation about my symptoms and was given medications that within a couple of days helped. But that doesn't happen in the United States because the doctor has to get his cut, the pharmacy has to get their share, and the drug company has to get their share. You have any insight about capitalism and the medical profession?
I've never noticed that. No. I'm interested to know. I'm interested to know if we're moving toward a breaking point on that. I mean, maybe you saw yesterday there was a new drug approved by the FDA for a cancer drug for sort of a fairly obscure use. A single dose is going to cost $375,000. And that doesn't count the other medicine that goes into it. That's just the drug. But it also requires a huge amount of medical care. And people are asking a lot. You know, there's no feedback. Drug companies get to set their prices at whatever they feel they can, whatever the market will bear is really the answer. And I think that since, I mean, the original research on that was done at the National Institutes of Health. And at some point they gave a license to the drug company saying, we've developed this up to this point. We know there's more work involved and it'll cost a lot more money just to develop it. We're giving you the license, you finish the development. But then my personal view is at that point, the government should say, and then come back to us and we will work together to set the price for this, to make sure you get a fair return on your investment, but also to make sure that a single dose of this drug does not cost $375,000 unless that really is what it costs to do. And I think it's a huge problem confronting medicine in this country. It's what almost one-fifth of the economy is wrapped up in this, which is much higher than it is anywhere else in the world. We do get a lot of value from it, but we also are making a lot of people really wealthy, and they don't. It's not a dialogue back and forth between citizens and these companies about what's fair. And I don't know. I mean, the system has developed a lot of drugs over the years. We've benefited from a lot of them, but I think it's reaching a breaking point. And I don't know how soon that's going to come. But my colleagues and I at NPR are watching those issues and saying, at what point is this? Are people just going to say, okay, we just can't keep doing this? And it's not just presidential tweets about drug companies making too much money. It has to be something more significant. And with the amount of money that's in politics, I think that's going to slow down the process of how quickly this happens. But I think, you know, as citizens, you know, you've put your finger on an issue that we all care about and that we have to resolve as a society, because we can't just, you know, we can afford medicine for everybody in this country if you make it reasonably priced. But if you have this kind of system where you have these kinds of huge disparities, I think it's just putting more and more stressors on the system. So, yeah, thank you for your question.
Maybe time for just a couple of more here.
I was curious to follow up on the woman behind me was asking about traveling around the world and environmental issues. And I was curious if you have some insight on both things that you've seen regarding people's carbon footprints in different areas of the world and you know, tangible solutions that we can do in the United States for our own carbon footprints, but also contrasting when people seek for a news story to always be the whiz-bang new science that's 10 or 15 years out, compared to reporting on things that people are actually doing now and actually charging in regards to their carbon footprint and reducing.
Yeah. I like my share of whiz-bang stories, but I agree it shouldn't be anything near all of it. But it's like, if we want to have, if you know, I remember I gave a talk about climate change once. I was at UC Santa Barbara, as I recall, and it was a kind of a grim picture. And at the end of it, the professor said, come on, you got to leave them with hope. You know, you don't want these kids to sort of leave and say, it's all, you know, forget it. I might as well just not even think about these issues. And I think that there are the technologies, the possibilities are there. And if people really focus on it, I think that you can make a big difference if you get, you see these young people engaged in these ideas and say, go for it, make better batteries, figure out how to make solar super cheap, do all of these things. And obviously, if it's less expensive to respond to these things, we'll adopt those technologies. So I took that to heart. It's like, I don't want to leave people feeling things are hopeless. And sometimes that means telling stories about, gee, if, you know, things are really moving along well with battery development and so on. And you know, let's hope that this is moving us, you know, into a more sustainable direction. I remember, as for the first part of your question, some years ago, I was in the incredibly poor nation of Niger in West Africa, and was visiting with people there who were there's some awareness of climate change there, but I mean they have so many other more immediate problems. If you talk to them, what's your concern? Climate change is not really high on their list, although it's driving some of the other things that are really affecting them in Niger. But I remember talking to a forester there who said, we actually absorb more carbon dioxide than we produce right now with our forests and so on. And so why are you telling us that we have to think about climate change and so on? And it was a sense of, you know, trying to pick up on that and take that idea somewhere and say, absolutely, you know, you are providing a service to the world right now. And the question is, how can we think about helping you to develop collectively, we, not just the United States, but, you know, how can you develop? Because, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, we drove through towns that when it got dark, there were no lights. Kids couldn't read. They couldn't do their homework, if they even had homework. People would go out in the front and sit around the bonfire or whatever. But there was not electricity in a lot of these villages that we were traveling through. And that's not a tenable situation for the human beings living there either. And so the question is, how do you bring them electricity in a meaningful way, and which is almost inevitably going to increase their carbon footprint to some extent, but how do you do that in the context of, you know, development versus helping them still be conscious of these issues and so on. And those are struggles that are playing out in the developing world for sure, and not easy answers. But one of the hopeful things is seeing how rapidly cell phones have expanded through Africa and elsewhere, because people in Niger may not have had electricity, but they could go at their homes, but they could charge their cell phones, and the cell phones are banks for them, because they can transfer money back and forth just by cell phones, and so it's sort of a leapfrog technology. You don't have to string up all these power lines, you don't have to do all these things, and the phones provide a really important service for them. So the question is, how can you take that small example and say, okay, how do we give people light at night? How do we do other things that are sort of using leapfrog technologies? And so they're interesting stories that are unfolding in these parts of the world, and as I say, people aren't even thinking about climate change really, but they recognize, you know, I want light at night, I want to be able to read a book so I can go, so my, when my kid's in school, when the sun goes down at 6:30 at night, they can still study and read and be ready for their classes in the morning and so on. It's a richly textured story to try to understand all the interlocking pieces and not say to them, well, you know, we developed all the electricity, we have all we want, and it's like, but we're at the limit now, no more, world can't keep growing. It's not a narrative that works, but finding the narrative that does work is a big challenge.
One more question? Sure, one more in the back.
So someone touched on capitalism in the pharmaceutical industry, and I was wondering if your book discusses at all not just the government's responsibility of funding science, but the decline in funding basic R&D in science and industry. So the pharmaceutical industry, I would say, actually is one of the leaders in industry of funding basic research, but the decline of things like Bell Labs or Xerox and physics or the physical sciences has caused a decline in funding and innovation there, and if your book discusses that, or if you have any opinions.
Yeah, I don't discuss it in a great deal of depth. I think that, we've gone back and forth with industry funding of universities, partly because of the conflicts of interest that it can create, but I think it's a conversation definitely worth having. The pharmaceutical industry relies very heavily on ideas that come out of universities, and they used to fund a lot more of that research, and they're doing much less of it now. And then they're complaining that the quality isn't up to snuff for them, and they're not getting the products out of the pipeline. They try to replicate these studies, and they can't. They say, what's wrong with universities? There's one kind of crazy idea, actually, by the president of Merck, the big drug company, who said, we'll fund more for research in universities with this caveat, that if it turns out that you're wrong, we want our money back. And he published this in a major journal and with a straight face. I'm not sure that's exactly the funding scheme that's going to be the successful one here. But anyway,
I think just to underscore that, I just saw a story this week about how the bananas that we consume so many of. That particular species of banana could be endangered in part because a lot of the big companies like Dole, Chiquita, have not made their own investments in research to try and find an answer to this fungus that is really devastating a lot of the banana crops. I think that just kind of underscores the point she was making about private business not making those investments. But any other thoughts on that?
No, I think it underscores dramatically the fact that this is a partnership, that we can't leave it all to industry and we can't leave it all to the government, but we do need to work together. But that means having fair rules of the road, right? And we those need to be adjusted right now. And I think ultimately as people look ahead and realize what we're confronting, I hope people realize, okay, we need to renegotiate these things, absolutely.
NPR science reporter and author of Rigor Mortis, Richard Harris.
And let me just also add my thanks to you all for being here tonight, to each and every one of you for your support of Illinois Public Media. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks to all the university partners who had a hand in bringing Richard to campus. Thanks, Richard, for spending so much time on campus. Sorry for working you so hard, but we deeply appreciate all the time you spent with our students. And thanks for all the great journalism. It makes me very proud to be a supporter and part of public radio. We look forward to a lot more. Look forward to reading your book. So let's close with one more big round of applause for Richard Harris.